Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined this morning by Claire Brock, journalist and broadcaster, Gary Murphy, professor of politics at DCU, and Roderick O'Gorman, leader of the Green Party and TD for Dublin West. That notion of the men coming out in solidarity, Claire, do you think there's much hope?
I actually thought when that message came in about men coming out in solidarity, that men would show up in skorts. I mean, look, this whole story, I mean, the women have taken such a strong stance here, coming out, protesting at that previous match that took place, Kilkenny, Dublin, and then being told to go back into the dressing room and change or the match would be abandoned. And I just think for this particular match, and we heard from Tara Power there, who was speaking to you, the Camogie Association with the Munster final, by cancelling that game between Cork and Waterford, have actually said to the players, have said to the country, that this is more about the attire than about the game itself. That this is what matters more to them, because they didn't want the players to show them up to come out, because this time they weren't going to go back in the dressing room and that game would have been abandoned. So, you know, very frustrating for the players. And I can see how even in their attempt to protest this match that was due to take place yesterday, how disempowered they must feel by that move by the association. So, I mean, the vote that's coming now on May 22nd, long overdue, it has to be said, even though...
Is it a guaranteed win?
...take place last year, but that was before it's really come back into sharp focus with the players bringing it into sharp
focus. We were speaking to Evany Quillan yesterday, and the point that she was making was that a vote that has been defeated, when it goes back for the second vote, it now needs a supermajority of 2-1. So there is no guarantee in a secret ballot that this will go through.
I just wonder who on that board taking that vote would vote to say, no, you must wear skorts, when all the players have overwhelmingly said, we don't want to do it. And we never did.
Well, any delegate who was thinking perhaps of voting to keep the skirt only should listen back to your interview with Tara there. It was extremely eloquent in relation to what is a choice issue. And there's some very good analysis in today's papers. Alison O'Connor and Christy O'Connor in the Sunday Times, Maria Call, and a brilliant piece by Eamon Sweeney in the sports section of the Sunday Indo, where he points out that the skirt is, you know, the last relic of old Catholic Ireland, the Ireland of John McQuaid, the Ireland of the Eighth Amendment. It is a... I mean, whether it's body shaming is too strong a word, but it's certainly a relic that needs to be, and it's anachronistic, and it needs to be got rid of. And if people want to wear the skirt, players who would be entitled to, under this, as I understand it, this new rule would be a choice. All the players apparently train in shorts, so we'd expect the vast majority to wear shorts in the game. And anyone who's watched Anton Camogie at senior level, the skill levels are off the charts. I mean, you go to I was at the All-Ireland final last year. Some of the skill level is just like, and the physicality is not for the faint-hearted either. It's a brilliant sport, and, you know, players need to be encouraged. And Eamon makes a very good point in his piece, and we know this. There's plenty of evidence to say that young women opt out of sport in their late teens and early 20s, and one of the issues is around... they're developing bodies. And in that context, it would seem to be the no-brainer of all no-brainers that this would be passed on the 22nd.
Now, on the topic of the 22nd, Roderick, I seem to remember, non-corporeal cabinet meetings to deal with things like the arrival of the IMF. It was possible to get everybody on a Zoom call and sort major policy decisions in relation to the nation. How is this taking so long? Why can they not just get together and say, lads, let's have a vote?
It does seem to be strung out. And I would love to understand how the Camogie Association let this issue get to such a, I suppose, a boiling point, a position where women, where players of the calibre of those playing at inter-county level felt that their only option was to take the risk of abandoning games. And there's a risk there in terms of their county's progression. But Tara, clearly described in terms of, you know, their training schedule. When you're an elite athlete like that, you peak at a particular time, and their time scale for peaking has now been completely disrupted. So the Camogie Association has allowed this happen. It is good that a Congress is taking place. There's an opportunity now for them to, I suppose, get us back on course. But you'd have to consider how an issue of such importance was allowed to kind of come to a boiling point like this and wasn't resolved earlier on. I've no doubt delegates understood the very strong feeling that players had. They took a decision in 2024 by quite a strong decision not to allow choice. I'd hope we see them listen to the players and make that reversed decision when this Congress comes about.
It is very strange though, Claire, in 2025 to be discussing, to have the front pages of our biggest selling newspaper dedicated to rules about what women are allowed to wear in public.
Yeah, it's unbelievable actually when this story obviously first came to light, and it has actually been going on for years. Actually, I read one quote that back in 1950s, this question was posed by women, by players, that they didn't want to wear the skirts while they were playing the game. So there's nothing new in it, but it's hard to believe that we're in 2025 and it's still an issue, and it is a front page issue at that. And as Tara was saying to you, you know, they want to talk about the game. They don't want to talk about what they're wearing, and they want to be allowed to play the game. And I thought actually that the Dublin Camogie County Board had a very practical response to this when they told their refs to let players play in shorts. Yep, make note of it, that's fine, but let the game go on. And I don't see how the Camogie Association couldn't have chosen to do that.
Well, it's interesting you say about the 1950s, because Tex just said it's a disgrace. Match. This has been a bone of contention for players for a long time. The organisation needs to get it together. 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. Roderick, if I remember correctly, Metrolink was one of those programmes that the Green Party was supportive of, and I assume still is. It's on the front page of the Business Post. Metro boss, grievous impact of mega build will be worth it. And there's an extensive interview inside the paper that effectively delineates the scale of this. We haven't done anything of this scale since Ardna Crusha, effectively. But the impact is going to be, according to the boss of the project, huge.
Yeah, Sean Sweeney sets out in detail the challenges that entail from a project of the size of Metrolink, and he points to the fact that there will be disruption, and you know, members of the public will be upset by that. And we've seen that before. We saw it during the construction of Lewis. Remember on Leeson Street, there was absolute ructions about that. We saw it during the construction of the Port Tunnel and the impact of drilling on homes in the north side of the city. And I wasn't around at the time, but when Dart was being built, there was also a lot of criticism there. But every one of those projects now provide enormous value to our city, to our country. And I think the central point that Sean Sweeney is making is that when Metrolink is complete, it will provide massive value. It'll give us that link.
Are we into when, or is it still if?
I want to see the government clearly set out the capital funding for it, because it's not funded in the current NDP. And that was a point I know Eamon Ryan made when he was minister. We have the opportunity now, maybe using some of the money from the surpluses, maybe using some of the money from the Apple account, to actually make it clear that their funding is there. Because one of the points Sean Sweeney made is that the uncertainty about this project and the fact that it was cancelled twice previously is actually one of the reasons why the projected costs are going up because the, I suppose, the markets who would finance a project of this scale, they're building in that degree of uncertainty. But the benefits it gives us, the link with Dublin Airport, finally, the ability of Swords to grow as a city, and in terms of the our need to build housing, Swords is one of those core locations where it is zoned for a major expansion, facilitating somewhere like DCU, facilitating students to be able to move easily, and just linking the north and the south of our city in a more coherent way. Huge benefits from the project.
We have seen recently our national struggle with planning issues. If you take the Dublin Airport passenger cap as case in point, there is one where it is the attempt to change a planning provision that doesn't require the pouring of any contract. Nothing tangible has to happen. Will warnings like we see on the front of the Business Post make it less likely that there'll be the political support for something like Metrolink?
I mean, I think look at the numbers that we got. We got a budget of what, so it was going to cost some 9.6 billion euro in 2021. Now, I think everyone accepts with inflationary costs and everything, it's never going to land at 9.6 billion. And then there's some estimation that it could come in more like 11.5 billion. And, you know, Dr. Sean Sweeney, who is the guy in charge of all of this, saying, look, expect cost overruns on international rail projects. They classically overrun by 40%. But I also think about the figure that was put forward of an extreme case scenario where this project would actually cost 23 billion euro in an extreme case. And this was put forward, I think it was Eamon Ryan had said, look, we have looked out at all of this. The figures are down there that's saying in an extreme case, this is what it will cost. I don't think it's probably going to land somewhere in the middle. It'll probably go up to something like 23 billion euro, and the 2035 deadline.
What's a few billion between?
What's a few billion more
between planners and developers? The big thing, Anton, I took out from Sean Sweeney's interview was his point that
this is the Metrolink boss.
Yeah, that we could, or he could, to use their oil, we, the citizens, we could expect fierce opposition, fierce public opposition, which would dissipate once Dubliners realised the value of it. But we're all long enough to know that. The planning laws and the procurement laws and the way people object to things means that this is a long way to go.
We had the one of the senior people from Ishka Éireann yesterday giving out about banana objections. This is be against anything, anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, and of course, there's some talk of reform in relation to being able to object to any scheme anywhere in the country if you're not from that particular environ. But I do think we can expect some ferocious opposition. Just the classic NIMBYism. Yeah, I'd love a metro, but I don't want it anywhere near me. Or I love a metro, but as long as it's like, you know, those people who say, oh, I love the poor, but keep them away from me. And I think there's a little bit of that here.
Interesting. The texts continue to come in, unsurprisingly, in relation to skorts. Wimbledon tennis changed to shorts ages ago. Now they're allowing darker shorts under white because of period anxiety. They are listening to their players. Another, Anton, speaking as a man and a father of two daughters, I don't think the male players need to come out in solidarity. To do so would, in my opinion, undermine the women's protest. The women have made a strong argument and protest, and they will see it through. To call on men to come in and save the day is just adding to the underlying problem of women's autonomy. And one saying, will this controversy spill over into the schools where skirts are mandatory for girls? Do we think it would?
Potentially, I suppose. One of the interesting things, and I think Evan said this to you, Anton, is that the current Evan Cullen, the Fine Gael senator and former RT presenter, the president is a man for the first time, the president of the Camogie Association, and this now would be the time, I think, for that president to show leadership. I think the people who were complaining about the politicians, and we saw Charlie McConnell, Logan Dahl and Patrick O'Donovan, a bit like, oh, it's all up for the Camogie Association, without coming straight out and saying, this is an anachronism, and the Camogie Association needs to change.
On the topic of politics, there is much that we need your expert analysis on, Gary. After the break, we need to find out whether or not Joe Duffy is going to be successful in his reputed run for the park. He hasn't said it. Loads of people are saying Joe would be a shoo-in. We'll get your thoughts on that. The other one that I want your view on is Gary Gannon is the new chair of the Dáil Committee looking at the inculcation and acceptance of the recommendations of the Citizens Assembly on drugs. He has given an interview in which he says that he, as a younger man, used drugs. There was a time not that long ago where that would have been fairly damaging to a political career. Are those days behind us? Does this matter at all?
It might matter somewhere. I don't think it would particularly matter in Gary's constituency of Dublin Central. He has been a ferocious advocate of the issues that drugs have, are the cause of drugs in relation to ongoing homelessness issues, social issues, and the blighted lives of those who have unfortunately become afflicted by drugs and their families. And I think if anyone deserves a little bit of a break from the Puritans about drug taking. Now, I'm a good bit older than Gary Gannon, but like in the mid-80s when I was in college, you couldn't go to any party without at least being offered some drug. I used to always say to people I prefer beer, which was true. But like anyone who's been in a university in this country in the last 50 years would know what Gary Gannon, I think, is talking about. And the fact that in his interview with Gabby Gatavaskaya, the fact that a senior politician can talk about this without the world collapsing, I think shows as something about modern Ireland.
Does it show that modern Ireland is more accepting of illegal drugs than it should be?
No, I don't think so. I think it speaks to a reality of modern Ireland right now. And look, Gary has a strong reputation on campaigning on this issue, and I think he's a good fit for chairing that committee. We did see real progress under the last government in terms of the Citizens Assembly on drug use, which ourselves and the Greens and others would have advocated for. Paul Reid did a good job there, brought out a set of really comprehensive actions, but now we actually have to see them implemented. One thing I would have liked to have seen the new government do is to take one of their key recommendations, which was a cabinet subcommittee on drug use, bringing together whether it's justice, health, education, all those areas. From my own experience, you know, we give out a lot about the mechanisms of government and the state, but a cabinet subcommittee is actually a place where the relevant politicians can tease out in more detail these issues that are interlinked across government departments, across agencies.
Is it not where policy goes to die?
No, it's not. It's not. It's if it is identified as a priority for a government, a cabinet subcommittee is actually a place where I suppose maybe the level of detail that you can't get into in a cabinet meeting actually can get teased out and a clear agreement be brought to cabinet. But unfortunately, the new government haven't taken that point up. They haven't given a clear indication of when the new drug strategy is going to be published. So I'm sure Gary and others sitting on the new Oireachtas Committee on Drugs will be a strong voice to pressure the government to make sure it acts and it builds on the momentum of the Citizens' Assembly.
Well, as I say, Gary Gannon will be with us in about half an hour, so we can ask him his both plans for the committee and also his reasoning for going public on his own use of drugs. 53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. After the break, speculation about Joe Duffy. Who is going to replace him on Liveline, or will Liveline continue? And is he going to run for the park? With me is Roderick O'Gorman, leader of the Green Party and TD for Dublin West, Claire Brock, journalist and broadcaster, and Gary Murphy, professor of politics at DCU. And texts continue to flood in respect of skorts and whether or not women should be told what they can wear in sport. The Camogie Association is formed of women, says a text, with the recent appointment of a man to chairperson. So this debacle is not down to him. It is not the GAA, which is a separate organisation, although it has to be said a sister organisation. Women are imposing this medieval rule on players, and when I talk to men about it, they are literally as bewildered as to what these women are thinking. Another, the main issue here is very typical for our national sports, GAA, LGFA and Camogie. Teams and management setups at county level are operating at a professional level and our organisations are very, very amateur. This should not have to become a revolution, but up the revolution, and the men should down tools, says the text. Well, if you have a view, as I say, 53106. So, speculation around Joe Duffy, who is going to replace him, and whether or not he is going to run for the park. I'll put the political side of that to our political experts, the broadcasting side. Who's the smart money on, Claire, for the new Liveline Hope?
Well, you tell me. Talk to Anton.
Are you in it for yourself, Claire?
It's a heavy load to carry, isn't it? 5 days a week, taking on the nation's problems. Yeah, he's going to be a tough man to replace. It's interesting, Willie O'Reilly, I think, was quoted in the Mail on Sunday there, formerly, of course, of Today FM and RTÉ's commercial director for many years, saying, you know, they need to consider carefully who they take on to replace Joe Duffy, because he is that voice of the nation that everyone knew for 27 years, and a voice that wasn't the middle class voice, he said, that is you hear right across the airwaves today. Having said that, of course, he was also someone who was on a considerable salary, and whoever takes the seat is not likely to get that salary again.
Well, there's a definite, you know, 100 grand drop, apparently, down from 350 to 250.
Well, naturally, because of the cap at 250,000 that has been imposed by the Director General, Kevin Backhurst, who said, well, no one's going to get paid more than me in the job. So it will be interesting, though, to see who takes it. There's a lot of names, of course, being put out there. I'd say anyone who's put themselves behind a microphone is out there as a potential name. But interesting to see who comes in. I mean, Patricia Monaghan, who's head of audio there now, formerly of this parish, yep, of course, goes without saying. She'll want to maybe make a statement, and you're likely to see movement there. So it will be interesting to see what happens, certainly in RTÉ. And
will they keep the show?
The autumn lineup. Oh, I can't imagine.
It's got a brand, hasn't it? Liveline, it's kind of got the brand that's been built up by Joe.
By
Marion Finucane, in fairness.
But a bit like the Late Late Show. I mean, they wouldn't leave the Late Late Show go. And after Gay Burnham, I did it with Pat Kenny and Ryan and Patrick Keelty. So I think the name is strong enough.
Who'd you call to complain, you know?
Oh, yeah, but like Jerry Ryan is the case in point, that they never managed to fill those shoes.
No, but it was the Jerry Ryan Show, whereas this is Liveline.
So, you talk to Joe, Gary.
I happen to think that Katie Hannon has done a very good job whenever she filled in for Joe, and her accent doesn't scream Southside Dublin. In fact, it screams Kerry, where she's from, and she always seemed to me to have the sort of the empathy to deal with people from across the social strata of our great country. But they'll take no notice of me, so that's the kiss of death for Katie. That's the kiss of death for Katie, I'm afraid.
Well, what about the other side of it? Because a number of people, including Ryan Tuberty in his column, saying Joe would be a shoo-in for the park. He should run for the Oris.
Why would he want to? Why would he want to take on that election? It's one of the most brutal elections in Irish politics. One of the good things about Irish politics is, by and large, a politician's private life and their family life is kind of seen generally as off limits. But come the presidency, it's no holds barred. And I think of someone like Mary Davis, like David Norris, like A.D. Roach. They were dragged over the coals in those elections. So Joe, after, you know, his service over 27 years, I'm not sure, does he want to put himself through 4-5 grueling months in order to take on that particular role?
It's four
unless he's absolutely
for
passionate about doing it.
14 years of painting deer in the park, doing the occasional event, being the first citizen of the nation. Does the latter not make the former worthwhile?
I think the elections we've seen every 7 years shows evidence of people who've thought about that bit, but haven't actually thought about the campaign and the scale of it, what you need to do to try and, you know, get around the entire country, the cost of it, but also it's just highly intrusive nature compared to other political campaigns in Ireland. It's almost unique in that way.
Why is that, Gary? You know that joke about academic politics, the it's being so vicious because the stakes are so low.
Yeah, that was Henry Kissinger before he went on to be the sort of the Machiavelli behind Nixon throne. And of course, having sat on numerous meetings at DCU about the most boring stuff, which people took ferocious sides on, I can fully sympathise and empathise with the former secretary, Mr. Kissinger. The presidency, Roderick, is right. I mean, and it's not even those who come from civil society, but look at Martin McGuinness in 2011, who was doing very well in the polls until the son of Private Kelly took him on in Athlone, and that was the end of his campaign. And in fact, I have great respect for the son of Private Kelly doing that. And it was as if, like, oh, you can't ask me questions about that. Well, you can ask questions about what you want. This is the whole journalist prerogative. And then when people dug into the backgrounds of so-called, I think celebrity candidates is too harsh, but for those from civil society, Roderick mentioned them, A.D. Roach, Mary Davis, George Freeman and others. I mean, who would want that level of intrusion?
But has Joe not already suffered that by virtue of his fame? Because people like A.D. Roach were thrust into a different spotlight than they had previously been in. Is there much more that we discover about Joe that we don't know?
Well, wouldn't that be, that's the question, I suppose. And that's the question he'd have to answer. I mean, many people know Joe's backstory as a child of Ballyfermot and his long student union politics, and then into RT, where he is a brilliant broadcaster, not just on Liveline, but on the meaning of life. I mean, anyone who's seen some of his interviews there, his empathy is quite extraordinary. And I think if he was to run, I wouldn't say he would be a guaranteed shoo-in, but like Ryan Tubridy says in his column, but he clearly would attract a large vote. But there was lots of talk many years ago that Micheála Muirchertaigh would run, that Fianna Fáil were looking for Gay Byrne to run, and lots of other people would run, and nothing came of any of these. And I suspect the same will be true for Joe Duff.
So where's the smart money currently? Mairead McGuinness? Michael McDowell?
Well, one would think Mairead McGuinness and Fine Gael would have a decent chance. But remember, Fine Gael got the huge number of 6.4% with Gay Mitchell in the 2011.
And have never taken the Oras.
And then, no, they haven't. They didn't run a candidate in 2018 when the establishment, for all the grief Michael D. Higgins has supposedly given the establishment in this country. In 2018, when they had their chance to oppose him, what did they do? They all rolled in behind him. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and the Labour Party. I've never been one to subscribe to this view that the president causes Micheál Martin and caused Leo Varadkar and caused Enda Kenny all this grief. It's all, in my view, quite nonsensical. They're quite happy for him to talk about whatever he wants to talk about and kind of shrug their shoulders and move on. I don't know if there'll be a kind of a government candidate with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael now basically married together. Or I don't know, will the Greens run? Maybe you should ask Roderick. Is he interested? Of course, he has a big job, you know, resurrecting the party.
Let him answer.
No. I'm, as Gary says, my focus is on rebuilding my party.
But would you want it at any point when the party is rebuilt and electoral success is returned and all that good stuff? Would you fancy the park?
I think 7 years is an incredibly long time to give yourself to any role. And that's why I would have made the case when we were talking about political reform maybe around 10, 11 years ago, when the original Citizens Assembly looked at a range of constitutional reviews, and one of the questions was, should we shorten the term limit to 5 years like most other countries?
President,
and
that wasn't, it would be 5 years, Roderick, would it be able?
I think it would actually promote more. It becomes so remote because it's every 7 years. Like I was 22 before I got to, I think it was 28 before I got to vote in my first presidential election, because President MacLeish ran unopposed the second time. Like, and that's a long time to have the franchise, but not I actually be able to give a view on it. So I think the ability to do it for the 7 year term, and also the ability to kind of run unopposed for a second term, I think those are both problematic and actually make the office become a bit more remote from people.
We talked a bit about media in the traditional form. There's stories relating to social media, and that being this proposal that the social media giants should have age limits placed upon them. I think this is a kite that Simon Harris had flown. There is resistance, apparently, from some unnamed social media giants saying that they don't exactly know what it is likely to consist of, and apparently resistance as well from Google and from Apple in terms of App Store age controls. Australia being touted as the model that we should follow. Do you think this is likely to come in?
Well, you see, the ban in Australia was passed, I think, late last year, but it's not coming into effect until December, and already apparently been utterly beset by problems on how you actually enforce any of this. Do you use Face ID to say, no, you look like you're 14 rather than 24, we're not going to let you in? That's also problematic, the issue of data and taking a child's face ID in order to permit them or ban them from their social media platform. And I also think, let's be honest, the power and influence of big tech means any of these proposals to date have just fallen flat. I mean, even the age verification, which is something that has been touted, as yet we are waiting for those rules to come into effect, and that's for age 13. So I suppose for government voices now to come out and saying, look, we should look to Australia, we should look to New Zealand and impose similar rules, I think it's quite far-fetched. I mean, Stephen Donnelly said this was a health emergency last year, and that this social media ban should be in place for teenagers, but sure, Nothing came about.
You have the power of big tech, but it, more importantly, it seems to me you have the ingenuity of teenagers. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's had a teenager's life, I've had three people go through their teens. I mean, they can do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And the idea, I think, that we can somehow stop them on the internet is a bit of an ask in my particular view, Anton.
Why? Why is it beyond the bounds to put in age verification? How can it's that not beyond, be?
No,
possible?
No, it's not beyond the bounds, but I think it'll be beyond the bounds of the companies to come up with something that can fool your pretty average teenager between 13 and 16. If they want to get on the internet and do stuff on social media, age verification, face recognition, it won't stop them.
But I think
I'd be amazed if it did. You look at me as if I have two heads, but I'd be amazed if it did.
I'm just optimistic about the prospect of high-tech solutions to these kind of problems.
But I also think that the pushback is there because of the strength of the algorithms that, you know, the tech pushback is there. Like they may say, we don't want, you know, very young kids accessing social media platforms. We agree and we have all your concerns. But at the end of the day, I feel like something could have come about sooner. If they were very serious about this matter.
I think one of the most significant things we could do that would have a really meaningful impact is compel the platforms to turn the recommender systems off. Those are the AI systems that look at what you've looked at so far and then start pumping more and more of that at you. And that, you know, uses a huge amount of personal data. All of that is stored. It is possible for them to turn that off. And I know here in Ireland, organisations like the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, they say that is one of the most effective ways. So particularly young people aren't being bombarded with whether it's images about self-harm, about eating disorders. That is a meaningful step. It recognises that young people are going to continue to access online, whether we put in place a 16 cutoff or not. Young people will find a way around it. But if we can lessen the ability of the platforms to actually start to really narrow down on a person and start and just kind of...
Although that is the business model.
You are challenging the business model and that's why it's so difficult. But I think it would be one of the most meaningful changes to make the online space safer, particularly for young people.
I'm always just baffled by the fact that they are able to do it when it is financially incentivized. If it comes to copyright infringement, where there is an issue that they may be sued by a universal or a copyright holder, they can move very fast to pull copyright issues, but they seem unable to come up with a similarly creative solution to protect kids.
Mm-hmm. And that's because, as you said, something like the recommender system is hugely important in terms of the business model that they operate. But I think that would be one of the most meaningful ways to make that space safer for young people.
Let us come full circle. We began with discussions of women's clothing. Let's end on the same topic. Gary, I know that you haven't been able to sleep for your concerns about this. Molly Malone is now costing us apparently a couple of hundred quid a day for people to guard her against being interfered with.
Exactly, against tourists in particular who apparently can't keep their hands off her. And good old
Why are we paying money to protect a statue?
Good old fashioned wear and tear has affected the great symbol of Dublin. We're paying so much because it means something to the citizens to have a statue in place. We're not in the case of tearing down statues. Which
but they're
of course,
not doing her any harm. There is no damage. Well, they are making her shinier than she otherwise would be in the area with which they interact.
The problem is it's a bit like coastal erosion. Sooner or later, the whole thing will sooner or later will collapse if nothing is done. I'm
Maybe
afraid.
She needs to be encased at this point, you know, surrounded so no one can touch.
But Alison O'Connor has a very good piece in the Sunday Times where she compares the skirts issue with Molly Malone. And that's why, because sooner or later the damage will get too much.
There's a long time before you would wear bronze away. Our tourist numbers would need to be fairly committed
the length of a presidential election
they're
term.
They're actually paying stewards, you know, €350 a day to man the Molly Malone statue from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. to stop people doing just that. I mean, are they putting their hands out and saying, no, look, don't touch, you know, or are they sort of stepping in when someone tries to get up close and personal with Molly? How's it all working? But it is is interesting, isn't it?
But the what happens after 9 o'clock?
About 20 years ago, we banished another very significant female representation of Dublin, Anne Olivia, from O'Connell Street all the way up to where she's now beside Croppy's Acre, looking a little bit sad up there.
They didn't even give her a backrest. She's in a permanent sit-up.
She's just kind of, yeah, a crunch. So I hope we don't see the same thing happening to Molly Malone.
So just doing the maths off the top of my head, because this is what the Sunday Times is reporting, thanks to Patrick O'Donoghue, that the City Council has launched Operation Malone. So this is in an effort, as they describe it, to halt the discoloration of the statue and its foundations becoming destabilized. I don't think it's its foundations where the problems lie. Two stewards are on duty from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. at a cost of 350 quid a day. So 350 quid a day so that's 2 grand a week-ish. So we're paying 80-something grand.
Would you do the job though, Anton? Would you stand there all day?
Well, for 80-something grand, just to say to Americans, look, would you mind not groping the statue? Yeah, you know, it's not bad work if you can get it.
Yeah, I don't know. Are they getting that? Are these lads getting that to stand there and do that job? Who came up with this big idea? I think, you know, just let it be. At the end of the day, yeah.
But they've even gone and interviewed the daughter of the person who made the statue.
Beloved of tourists, but how many Dubs really love that Molly Malone statue? I mean, how much of a favourite is it with
Patrick has interviewed Audrey
Irish people
Elliot, whose mother created the statue, and she makes the point that obviously she has a proprietary interest in it and in seeing it sort of flourish. I suppose one might say. And there's a great picture, basically, of a woman touching Molly Malone's breast, accompanying the story, which might give readers the
while it has to be said, a city council steward appears to be leaping to her rescue. Anyway, a text saying, if Molly Malone's dignity matters so much, either put a railing around her or put her at a higher level. Seriously, this isn't rocket scientist or science, rather. And
maybe the social media companies will come up with a solution, Anton.
Well, interesting on that. A lot of people aggravated by that, saying it should be illegal for anyone under 16 to have a smartphone. Algorithms are pushing kids to extreme points of view. The addictive nature of smartphones prevents learning. Another saying, recent research has shown that excessive use of social media is significantly harmful to young people's health. Fintech companies like Revolut and N26 have working identity and age verification systems. The social media companies could easily implement same, but need to be forced to do so. Guys, thank you very much. Roderick O'Gorman, Claire Brock and Gary Murphy.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.